podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Jones! Bowden!
He's got it! England have won the World Cup by the barest of margins!
Stokes flashes it away through the covers for four, and England have won the match!
Hello, welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket. Monday, the 25th of July, and one white ball series, England-South Africa, is over. Another one is about to begin. The England treadmill rolls on. So we're going to talk today about what we've learned about England's one-day side so far in the last few weeks, and also look at some tremendous performances in county cricket as well, including that amazing Sam Northeast, 410 not out for Glamorgan. But I suppose, Simon, we should start with this is the week, or the week that's just gone, when Ben Stokes retired from ODI cricket, played his last ODI in Durham. What have we learnt so far?
Well, it seems like the weather doesn't appreciate Ben Stokes' decision to retire from one-day international cricket, because it was a blazing hot day at Durham on his last day. And ever since then, it seemed to have rained, and it sort of rather ruined the end of the one-day series between South Africa and England. We'll come on to that in just a moment. But I'm going to start with a question for you, Yoz. What's the most cricket you played over a consecutive number of days? Because you used to play a sort of relentless schedule, didn't you, back in the day? You'd play championship match, Sunday league championship match. What's the most you played in a particular spell?
Well, I suppose we do have to emphasise the fact that it was back in the day. In about 1988, I played 30 days out of 31 in August. And that was because, as you rightly said, we played three-day cricket, Saturday, Monday, Tuesday, with a Sunday league match wedged in between, which was often at a different venue, by the way. So I remember once, you know, playing Middlesex Nottinghamshire at Lord's, Saturday, Monday, Tuesday, and the Sunday league game between the same two teams was scheduled at Trent Bridge. So, you know, the same bunch of players travelling up and down the M1 just to play a 40-over game. Madness.
That's absolute crackers, isn't it? And I think people at the time...
crackers.
Yeah, people at the time said
generally, the fixture organisers were quite sympathetic and managed to fit in, you know, a few days gap with this sort of 16 or even sometimes 23-day games we had to play and all of the one-day cricket. So you'd get a, you know, 4 or 5 day break or a week sometimes break. But that particular August, for some reason, we literally had one day off. And it was, well, you just almost sort of surviving on adrenaline, really.
What was it like, sort of? I mean, you obviously knew this schedule was sort of unfolding in front of you over the course of August. So how did you feel, say, midway through? How did you feel at the end?
It was sort of, I think you just have to get on with it. It's a bit like, I'm sure there'll be people listening to this who've worked, you know, constantly at whatever coalface they're at, and have had to, you know, do 7 day weeks and, you know, work late into the night and all that. I mean, people are doing that more and more, it seems, actually, at the moment. Yeah. I mean, obviously, NHS staff, people like that, have to absolutely, you know, to the grindstone. So, you know, it's playing cricket, so I suppose it's not that bad, but it was pretty tough, actually. And in a way, the worst part was the travelling. Because, you know, I remember once, for instance, I think it was in this spell, actually, we finished a match at Headingley on the Friday, and we were in the field, and the match went right to the end, 6 o'clock finish. Then we had to jump in the car Friday night in August, so a lot of sort of holiday traffic on a Friday night, and we had to travel to Hove. We got to Brighton at probably, I don't know, 11:30 at night, having had a whole day in the field, so you're really stiff when you get out of the car. Get into bed and probably not sleep that well because of the driving, you know, sort of tailgating and all that. And then we got to Hove on Saturday morning, beautiful day, lost the toss, in the field again. Oh my God, you know, that was tough. So you just go through the motions in those situations and obviously don't give of your best, but you sort of get through it somehow.
So the modern day players have never had it so good. Am I right? Or actually, you know, we're still on that treadmill, actually, and it does need to improve even more. There is still too much cricket. The reason I say that, of course, is England are in this schedule at the moment where they're playing, you know, 12 matches in 25 days, which doesn't sound a huge amount if you say it like that in a way. But, you know, there is the travelling, there is the preparation time, and there was that situation last week where they went from Old Trafford on the Sunday against India, really intense match against India, series decided, a big crowd, warm day in Manchester, and then the next day they're on the road in the bus up to Newcastle, you know, which is sort of 3 hours, and then you know they were then in the field on that roasting hot afternoon. I mean, it was a punishing day. I mean, everyone would experience it last week. There were amazing temperatures, and you know, South Africa got 300, England couldn't get enough, and lost the opening game, and that, you know, it felt a bit flat. And Josh Butler, you know, was saying beforehand, you know, it's poor scheduling, and he's been talking about it subsequently, saying, you know, there hasn't been enough time to prepare for matches, and that's probably fair enough, isn't it? I mean, there used to be a regulation where you'd have 2 days between a one-day international, but because of the scheduling this summer, but I presume because they had to fit that India Test match in, that, you know, there just isn't the wriggle room in the schedule. It's the 100 to come as well. It's a house of cards, isn't it? You know, you take one card out and it all just falls down, and you've got to sort of keep on going. It's fairly relentless, and for someone like Butler, actually, he's been in the middle of that because he's been trying to galvanise this one-day team. He wants to sort of mould it in his own image, and he's not always had the players that he wants for one reason or another, and it's actually been quite a frustrating time for him.
Yeah, it is a frustrating time, and I think he finds it difficult as well because he's very meticulous in his preparation. He likes to do everything a certain way, and he likes to have time to get ready physically and mentally for each game, which is why, actually, I think why, for instance, in the IPL for the Rajasthan Royals, he performed so well, because he had the time to really prepare, think through how he was going to play in particular games, analyse the opposition, work out the particular bowlers he's going to face and where he's going to hit the ball and so on. He likes that
and
way
without the travelling, yours as well. Really without the travelling this time
and
round.
And without the travelling, yeah.
Scheduled.
Well, yeah. Particularly in the last IPL. Yeah, that's a good point. I think, I mean, you use the word intensity, and that is the difference between the play now and, you know, going back to my time. It is far more intense. Obviously, it's international cricket. There is a huge amount of analysis on it. You can't just, for instance, I mean, you know, when we went through those spells of 28 days in 31 or whatever, 30 days in 31, you know, there would be days when you probably did put your foot out on the boundary to stop the ball because you were too tired to bend down and it bounced off your foot and went over the line. Well, there's nobody filming that and putting it out on YouTube for, you know, a million people to laugh at. Whereas now, the contrast being anything you do that doesn't look too good just gets poured over and repeated, and, you know, it becomes embarrassing. So microscopic attention on everything that's going on in the game. And also, the other thing I'd say is about preparation. The preparation is almost as hard sometimes as the playing of the game itself, because, you know, I can remember, you know, when Jonathan Trott was playing for England, he used to say, well, you know, I need to hit 200 balls before I can be ready to bat.
And might be more than that, mightn't it?
Maybe more, yeah. And, you know, they become conditioned almost, it's almost an addiction, preparation. Well, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with preparing properly for cricket, of course, because it's a very technical game and, you know, you do need to be ready. And I don't proudly repeat the stories about, you know, my appearances in a NatWest final where I turned up late because of the traffic and obviously because I was a late person anyway and didn't have a net. And actually bowled quite well in the final. You know, that's not to say that that's how you should behave. But I think sometimes people do become almost too reliant on preparation because that's what they've done, and they find it difficult to perform if they hadn't done the correct amount of preparation.
I think it depends on the individual, doesn't it? I think if you know, people have set a lot of store by their preparation, that, you know, you don't feel mentally right if you go on the field without having done that, and so it's different things for different people, isn't it? I think, you know, back in the day, talking about that again, you know, Ian Botham, for example, I don't think he was the most assiduous trainer of all time, or netter,
he had a
whatever.
Bath. His preparation before a game was have a bath.
Mm. And Inzamam, for example, I mean, often when fielding practice was going on, you'd be sitting in his chair, wouldn't he, out on the outfield, watching it all happen. Inzamam will hack, and you know, he was a wonderful player. But obviously, you know, there were flaws in his game as well. He wasn't a particularly good runner between the wickets, for example. So okay, so we've had this, you know, very intense schedule. There's been a casualty. We haven't had a chance to talk about it actually because it happened after our last podcast. I was actually on my way up to Durham and I saw this email from the ECB. Oh goodness me, that is a significant story. Ben Stokes, last one day international tomorrow, and you sort of, you immediately think, well, you know, perhaps he's just going to duck out of one day and he might just come back, and, you know, for the World Cup next year. But I mean, it doesn't seem like that, does it? It does seem as though that is it from Ben Stokes. What was your reaction to it? And does it when you actually sort of think it through, does it seem an entirely logical decision to take?
Well, it does. Although actually, I was in some ways I was slightly surprised because I think ODIs is his best format, other than tests. I think he's better in ODI cricket because he's, you know, a guy who can build an innings or rebuild an innings. Obviously, he has a big impact in the field and with the ball. He can take wickets at key times, bowl five overs here and there. You know, so he's an invaluable one-day performer. Clearly, the climax for his career was that amazing World Cup final performance. Whereas actually in T20, he's actually not that good, I don't think. I think he's someone who, a couple of IPL recently, he's been quite insignificant. He hasn't been able to bowl effectively. And his batting, he was taking a bit of time to get in and not really capitalising. So in a way, of the white ball formats, I think ODIs are his better format. But of course, if you think about the future and T20... That's where the dosh is, isn't it?
The gold is in the hills, isn't it? And that's what, you know, the T20 gold is in their hills. That, you know, you're not going to duck out of T20 cricket because that is the future. That's where, yeah, you know, there are future riches to be made, and you know, not just you know commercial value as well, and endorsements, all that sort of thing.
Yeah, and I think it does signal, if we haven't seen it before, the kind of decline of 50 over cricket as a format. That doesn't mean that it won't still exist. I think that there'll still be World Cups, 50 over World Cups in the future, but that doesn't necessarily mean, and Owen Morgan has been one of the people saying this, that you don't have to have a 50 over tournament, a domestic tournament, to get ready for 50 over, because 50 over is almost like just two lots of T20s, really. And the way England were playing.
Are you sure about that?
I mean, it's not exactly the same, but Owen Morgan's view was you pretty much bat in ODIs as if you're playing T20. There are times when you have to rebuild an innings or whatever, which you don't have the opportunity to do in T20, but the openers have a similar kind of approach. You're looking to hit boundaries early on in the power play and be aggressive.
Yeah.
Obviously, in 50 over cricket, there's only four men on the boundary for the first 40 overs, or that middle power play, until the last 10, when you can have five men on the boundary. So even more encouragement to play big shots. So pretty much it is sort of T20 with you know, just slightly scaling back your ambitions to hit sixes all the time. So I don't think you need 50 over cricket. I actually quite like people's suggestion, and of course this is another format, but 40 overs was, well, and you know, when I was talking earlier about the old schedules where we play 3-day cricket and 40 overs on a Sunday, 40 over cricket was brilliant because it was quite a good game, and yet it wasn't too long. It fitted into an afternoon. And the trouble with 50 over cricket, it just takes forever, doesn't it? You know, you start at sort of 10:30, 11, and you're still there at 6:30. It's a whole day, whereas 40 overs slotted in beautifully to an afternoon.
Yeah, one thing you have to think about though is the paying public. I think what's interesting, or what I found interesting over the last couple of weeks, going around the country watching some of these matches, you turn up at the grounds and the grounds are full. You know, it's not like people are saying, oh, I'm not really interested in this. Not like, you know, like say the Monday of a test match where the ground is a third full or anything like that. You know, the people turn up to watch because you do get the chance to see everyone, you know, everyone bat and bowl in that day's play, or, you know, both teams. So you get all the skills, all the players on show over a concerted length of time as well. It's not, you know, it's not just over in a 2 or 3 hours. It is a real day out, and people are getting, even at Durham. I mean, the incredible thing was at Durham on Tuesday, in that searing heat, I mean, it was, I don't think I could have stuck it if I'd had a ticket and was sitting outside for the day. There's very little cover at the Riverside. People stuck at it. I mean, there were a few people who struggled, and there were a few people who they set up a cold room actually in one of the buildings. People could go and just cool down. But generally speaking, looking around the ground, most of the seats were filled for all of the day. So people are sort of very committed to going, and it's your chance, isn't it, in your local area to go to a game. There might be just one match in your area that summer, and it's your chance to go along. It's a one day international, and people have turned up to watch. And you think of the passionate atmosphere there was at Old Trafford last Sunday week for that India final against England. It was big crowd in, and everyone was really committed to their team winning the match. So that I don't think the paying public have fallen out of love with 50 over cricket. So I think that's something to bear in mind. It's just perhaps the players have. I don't know, they're so attuned to 2020 now and the 2020 leagues, and it's the amount of cricket, isn't it? And I think one day international strikes me as being sort of one of actually the most demanding forms of the game. Sometimes a day in the field in Test cricket can be tough, but you got those breaks, haven't you? After every 2 hours, at least you can get off the field. That one day or the other day, England were in the field for 3 hours 50 minutes. It's a long time to be out there. And it's intense as well. It's very intense. Yeah. So I don't know. Perhaps it's something the players are not so keen on. Although I heard Quinton de Kock talking after yesterday's game, saying the players still love 50 over cricket and they want they want to win World Cups, and they're committed to doing so. And it's in the future tours program as well. It's not as if there's going to be. It doesn't seem as if there's going to be less 50 over cricket in the future. There's going to be the same amount, if not even more, because boards probably see that as a way of making money. I mean, I'm sure the ECB and the various grounds have made money in the last few weeks playing 50 over cricket, because the grounds have been pretty full. So there's always that sort of bottom line. It's just about spacing things out a little bit more and giving players that preparation time, so you don't have game travel game, as actually we've had twice, haven't we, in consecutive weekends, because Old Trafford, Headingley this weekend, that's not a huge journey, but then Old Trafford and then Durham last weekend with just the one day in between. So it's about finding that balance of in the schedule. Okay, y'all, so we're at the end of the one-day international summer. There are T20s to come, and is T20 all the way now for England till the World Cup? The schedule, very briefly, they've got 3 matches against South Africa, 7 matches against Pakistan in Pakistan, 3 matches against Australia in Australia before the T20 World Cup, which is in October and November in Australia. And England don't play one day until, bizarrely, they've got a 3-match series against Australia after the World Cup. So that, that's sort of fixture fulfilment. And then there's a couple of series next year that they've got to fulfil the fixtures from competitions that have been postponed. One in South Africa, which we think is going to be in February, and one against Bangladesh, which we think is going to be in March. So those are the one dayers for England in the future.
I'm feeling exhausted just listening to that list.
I know. Well, that's the problem, isn't it? That's the problem. There's also Test matches as well to fit in, and that T20 World Cup as well. Anyway, the bottom line is no more one dayers until after the T20 World Cup. So. And there is a one day World Cup next year in India, in autumn next year. So let's just focus on one day international cricket for now. Leave T20 aside, because the focus will come on to that as time goes on. Where is this England one day side? In transition, no Stokes, new captain, new coach, bowlers unfit, bowlers coming into the side trying to make their way. How good is this England one day side now?
Yeah, I mean, I think you sort of summed it up pretty well there. Obviously, they're missing key bowlers. The batting hasn't really fired, has it? Jason Roy, for me, is a bit of a worry. He's had a few injuries, and he's had some time out of the team for other reasons. He didn't perform particularly well. Three innings, in fact, only two innings. He made a 43, but it generally hasn't looked quite himself this summer, playing either T20 or ODIs. He will come under pressure, and it sounds sacrilegious to say it, but there are young guns waiting in the wings, the likes of Phil Salt and so on. Bairstow's still performing pretty well. Obviously no output from Butler, but we can write that off as just being rushed into trying to perform in too many games in too few days, not right preparation, having to captain a new team and so on. I think obviously the absence of Owen Morgan is massive, not just as captain, but also as someone who can just, you know, lead from the front. It's a terrible cliche, but he does. He did. He came into bat and he was on message all the time. It was very important that he stayed on message and played how he wanted the team to play, completely sacrificed his own possibilities or, you know, averages or whatever, just to play for the team, and obviously performed brilliantly well in many instances. And they'll obviously miss Stokes as well. I mean, Stokes leaves a massive hole in that side. So it is a much weaker side than it was in 2019, with the additional point of missing the likes of Archer, Wokes, Wood. You know, those guys don't get replaced immediately or easily. They've put a big emphasis on left-arm seam, haven't they? Mm. You know, Willie, Topley...
Is that coincidence, and, you think? Sam, you think that's just coincidence?
No, I don't think it is. I think it's always been viewed that left-arm seam, if it's good, is a harder type of bowling to hit for the average right-hander in shorter formats because of the angle and because of the natural trajectories and so on, especially if they can bowl cutters as well, the one that spins away from the right-hander, like a little sort of almost a leg break from a left-arm spinner. If they can bowl that, and, you know, maybe a back-of-the-hander as well, if they've got the variety, and in Reece Topley's case, he's also got the height as well, excessive height, which, again, makes a bowler much harder to get on top of on a sort of bouncy pitch. So I don't think there's coincidence, but I think David Willey is probably, you know, substituting for the absence of a Wood or an Archer. He's the next best alternative because he's so multi-purpose. Mm. He's one of the fittest players there is. He can obviously bat effectively and he bowls in different phases. So he's a very adaptable cricketer, but I don't see him being in the frontline team. What do England need to do? They've got to find an obvious replacement for Stokes, ultimately, and get those bowlers back in shape, ultimately. Otherwise, just don't see them competing for the finals again.
No, I agree with you. I mean, I can't see at the moment. I think England might struggle in the next World Cup in India. Just a reminder, it's another one of those round-robin competitions. So 10 teams are going
to
be playing.
So just to clarify,
again,
we're talking about the 50-over World Cup now.
The 50-over World Cup,
2023,
yeah.
In India, yeah.
Yeah, just over a year's time. And it'll come round very quickly. And it's a 10-team tournament. Everyone plays everyone, as in the last World Cup. And then the top four go through to the semi-finals. I mean, one thing that you know will happen, I think, in India is some of the subcontinental teams will be drawn more into it. So teams like Bangladesh and Sri Lanka, I think, will be much more competitive in Indian conditions than, say, perhaps they were in England. And definitely Pakistan as well. So, you know, I think the competition will be fierce and I think that will make it quite tough for England. I mean, quite a few of the England players now go play in the IPL, so they're sort of used to Indian conditions more, so that might help them. But, yeah, the bowling just looks, I don't know, looks a bit thin. I wonder whether England need to find another spinner as well. I mean, they use Liam Livingstone, don't they, as their sort of third spinner. Rashid is there, Moeen Ali is there. You'd think those are the two that are going to progress to that competition. It looks to me, actually, I thought one thing they did do as Yoz, which was interesting, was that with Ben Stokes going out of the side, they brought Phil Salt in, so they've Roy and Bess, so Salt batting at three. So basically you've got that sort of ultra aggressive top three, and then Joe Root, who wasn't number three, dropped down to number four, which is, so that there is a tactical change there, isn't there? Which is that, you know, Root is not coming in. Say if England lose an early wicket in the power play, Root is not coming in. You've got Phil Salt to come in the power play and to continue to take it on. So I thought that was an interesting tactical change from England. But, yeah, they just look... I think the batting is solid enough. I mean, just on Jason Roy, I mean, I'm a big fan of Jason Roy. I think he's one of those players you persevere with. You know, all players go through slumps. He's 32. He has done it. stick with him. I mean, they've done it with other players as well, haven't they? I mean, they've done it with Zach Crawley, for example, in the Test match team. Why not do it with Jason Roy in the one-day international team or the white ball team? So I wouldn't look to change that at the moment, not at all. It's easy just to say, oh, now we've had enough of him. There are lots of other exciting players. If that continues, yeah, then you might want to have a look. And actually, just on Zach Crawley, we should just pause for a moment, because both of us picked up on that LBW decision he got in the Kent versus Warwickshire game, didn't we? Now at the moment, we're in this Red Bull phase where Kent have played a couple of first class matches up to today, the 25th of July, and Crawley hasn't got any runs. 5-35, 17-25. But he did get an LBW, I thought a really harsh LBW decision. Hannon Dolby won the decision from the umpire when he was padding up in the championship match. And you said as well, not out, didn't you? I saw you on Twitter saying, he played no shot. But I'm sure in a test match, you'd have reviewed that and it had been shown not to be hitting the stumps. So, it's that fine margin, isn't it? But he still hasn't come up with many runs. It's worth noting.
Yeah. And I feel sorry for him, actually. I mean, he must have just thought, well, everything's against me at the moment, when he was given LBW in that game. I was tempted to actually freeze it and draw red lines on the screen where the stumps were and prove that it wasn't out. But I didn't go that far. Life's too short. But, I do feel for him. And I'm sure England will stick with him. But it would be good if he did get some runs somewhere before the South Africa test start in 3 weeks' time.
Yeah. So that's Zach Crawley. Just a little aside there. But, just going back to the England one-day side. Yeah, they look... I mean, they'll be competitive, won't they? I mean, they'll be interesting to watch and exciting to watch. And they'll frustrate and they'll delight and excite, because that's the nature of the way they play. But they just look a bit thin at the moment. I think they do need a couple more bowlers. They just look a bit thin on the bowling side. And, we've said it many times, you said it many times, the vital role that Liam Plunkett played in the rejuvenation of that England side, it cannot be underestimated. He was such an important member of that team. And, of course, someone like Archer as well, Wokeswood. I mean, the batting is sort of similar-ish, isn't it? But the bowling sort of had the heart ripped out of it. And, there are players competing and trying to find their way, but they're not quite the sort of the gun bowlers that England had in white ball cricket. So, yeah, it might be quite a hard road ahead for Josh Butler as he looks to sort of create a new era and sort of galvanise the team.
It always is when you're inheriting a winning team, a World Cup winning team, and the problem is, and it's the old line, isn't it? It's not as hard getting to the top as staying at the top.
Yeah.
Because, firstly, things change. The team gradually peters away, lose players to injuries and retirement and so on. So that World Cup winning team has never played together since. But also, other countries catch up. And look at India. They've seen how England played, how England approached that ODI format. And they've started to be more aggressive in the power play now. Other teams have bought into that philosophy as well. And other teams are catching up with England and have started to play that way and play it a bit better than an injury and retirement ravaged England.
Yeah, it's interesting actually watching South Africa play in this series. I mean, there were a couple of a real sort of mixed bag for them. But I thought they at Durham, they played quite old school one day international cricket. And it was actually quite dull in a way, but mighty effective to get them up to that 330. They knew that was, a really competitive score. And it was a hot afternoon, not much England, in a way, not a lot England could do about it. The pitch was okay, and then it just got a bit grabby. But it wasn't, they didn't hit a six, for example, in their innings. It feels almost unheard of now. And then, of course, you go to Old Trafford on Friday, they seemed to bowl well, and then they fell in a heap, all out for 80. So, I mean, they're quite a, talented side. They've got something about them. Actually, they've got a very good recent record in T20. They've been excellent so far this year. So it'll be interesting to see how they get on against England over the next few days in T20. And I note that India have gone to the West Indies, and it's not their full side, but not by any means. And they've gone there and they've taken a 2-0 lead. A couple of very interesting games, actually quite tight games that India have won. So they've got such a. It seems to me they've got such a pool of talent India, that they have got players that can come in. You know, if someone was injured or whatever, if someone did decide to retire, you know, they've got players that could come in. And yeah, well, we know that they're a powerhouse. Listen, Yoz, before we go, we should talk about Sam Northeast. What was the highest individual score in a match that you can remember, you were involved in your championship days?
Funnily enough, I avoided by a few months the highest score of all time, 501, Brian Lara,
yeah,
who made that, of course, against Durham, 1994, yeah, literally a few months after I'd retired. So
how many would have got if you'd been playing? If you'd been playing, you'd have got 700.
600. He could, yeah.
No, not six, seven.
so I narrowly avoided that. Actual fact, I was lucky that I played in a Middlesex team which had a very good bowling attack most of the time. And, you know, people will say, well, how are you part of it? And sometimes I do wonder. But it was largely an international attack, so people didn't get big highs, big hundreds or big scores against us too often. The highest I can actually remember was very early in my career, where actually Mike Brearley, so it was that long ago, Mike Brearley was captain, and it was Richard Hadley was batting for Notts and was actually a really decent batsman, even though he was famous for his bowling. He could really belt it and play a long innings. And he was about 60-odd out, and Notts were four down, and we were, you know, not looking too threatening with the ball. And Brearley said to me, who do you think should bowl? And I said, why are you asking me? I'm, you know, playing my fifth game or something. And he said, well, you're part of this team. I want you to have a think about it and tell me who should bowl next. You're a very important part of the team, even though you've only just started. I said, really? You know, you're the England captain. Surely you should know. And that's what I thought to myself, even though I didn't really say it. Anyway, he said, no, I want to know. Who do you think should bowl? So I said, OK, I think Norman Cowans should have a bowl. He hasn't bowled for a while. So Brearley was like, okay. And I thought he would take absolutely no notice of it at all. But sure enough, two overs later, Cowans was introduced and reintroduced and bowled a short spell. And, you know, obviously that made me feel absolutely amazing, because the England captain had trusted my judgment and acted on it and actually put the person on who I'd suggested. Absolutely amazing feeling for me. Unfortunately, Hadley went on to get about 190, and we didn't take a wicket for another 2 hours. So, you know, it was a sort of double-edged sword. But that was probably one of the highest scores I can remember a player making. I don't remember a double hundred against a Middlesex attack, which had, you know, a fearsome fast bowler in Wayne Daniel for most of the time, some very good support fast bowlers like I mentioned, Norman Cowans, and incredible spinners like John Embry and Phil Edmonds, and then later Phil Tufnell. So, and Angus Fraser was in that mix too. So, you know, a very good attack who didn't let batsmen get big scores, because actually the captains, Brearley and then later Gatting, were very good at manipulating their bowling attack to make sure that nobody got on top.
Yeah. And you yourself as well, Yoz, as well. You know, well, that 600-odd, what was it, 666 first-class wickets? Was that you or was that someone else?
No, I don't think it was as many as that. But it was probably, in all, about 750, but that's adding one-day wickets together with the first-class.
So we're talking about Sam Northeast making 410 not out. And actually, it was fascinating on Saturday lunchtime. You think, 410 not out, you could break Brian Lara's record. But of course, unfortunately, in a way for Sam Northeast, Glamorgan were in the chance of winning the game, and they're also in the chance of winning promotion as well. So, you know, they talked about it, and they talked about a declaration, and they did declare, and of course they won the game. So, you know, it was utterly justified. There was a conversation about batting on for a bit longer to break the all-time sixth wicket record. I think they needed 28 more runs to break the all-time record for a partnership for the sixth wicket in first-class cricket, and he needed close on another 100 runs to break Brian Lara's record. I listened to or read an interview with him where he said, you know, how are you going to celebrate? And he said, well, I'm going to a barbecue and, you know, I'll have a few drinks and mates. And then what did he say? It's back to the grind of county cricket. You know, which, you know, it's all back. You know, it's the sort of constant theme, isn't it, really? You know, so much cricket being played. Although I don't know where Sam Northeast is going to return to play cricket. He hasn't played a white ball game since 2019, and Glamorgan don't have another championship match until September. They play four championship matches in September, and he's not part of the 100 team. So I don't know whether
weird, yeah, isn't it?
I don't know.
Well, it's so weird. It's either feast or famine at the moment. The schedule, isn't it? What an amazing achievement!
Fantastic.
410. You know, that's probably almost as many runs as I made in my entire career, and he's got it in one innings. I mean, it's fantastic effort. Only two scores higher in championship cricket, that Lara 501 and Archie McLaren way back in about 1920, got 424 for Lancashire. So he's overtaken Graham Hick. I was playing not in that match when Hick made 405, but around that time. And I mean, Hick was a phenomenal batsman who could pile up big scores. And it's hard to imagine anyone beating that 405, but now it has been. So an extraordinary achievement by Sam Northeast, who I first met. He was in and out of the commentary box. He was great friends with Mark Nicholas, actually, or his family were, from Harrow School. And he used to be in and out of our commentary box for whatever reason, sort of 10, 15 years ago. And I remember Mark at the time saying he's one to watch. He's a really talented player, and he never has quite got the opportunity. He's never had the opportunity, obviously, at playing international cricket, but he's always been somebody, a name on someone's lips, a selector's thoughts. Never quite managed to string together enough performances to make a cast iron case for being included. One of those highly talented players who's perhaps missed the boat, but had a great day in the sun.
Yeah, he's going to be 33 in October. So, yeah, you'd probably say, you know, his time has gone. Although he is one of the rare players in first-class cricket, so relatively rare, who averages over 40.
Well, it does help getting
it does.
410.
It does, yeah. A bit of red ink and lots of runs. It's nudged his average over 40 now. Yoz, I knew there was a 6-6 in your wicket-taking column. It's 466 first-class wickets, not to be sniffed at, and 272 List A wickets as well. So, yeah, so there we go. That was your final analysis. I think that's just about it, isn't it, for this episode, Yoz? We'll see where we go with England's T20 side, and then the 100 starts, and then it's back to Test cricket, and then it's off to Pakistan with the T20 side, and then it's the World Cup, and then it's England-Pakistan, and then it's England-New Zealand.
it's just amazing, isn't it? I mean, there's been so much international cricket this summer already, hasn't there? It feels like we've had a whole summer.
Yeah.
And we've still got about 2 months to go, so... Good. I mean, it's great. It's hard for the players, but it's not bad for the spectators or the podcasters.
Yeah, absolutely.
So we'll be back. We'll be back with a report on the next game. In fact, I've got an interview coming up with a very interesting character, a former South African great, will be our next podcast. I'll just titillate you with that little teaser, and we'll be back later in the week. In the meantime, thanks for listening.
Sports Social Podcast Network.